Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
My place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Now, long dismissed as a technology of the distant future, artificial intelligence, or AI, was a project that was once consigned to the fringes of the scientific community. And then two researchers changed everything. We're going to find out who those people were and the kind of story of the people behind AI. And we talked to Silicon Valley journalist Cade Metz about his new book. Hi, Cade. Thanks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's an interesting one, this, because it's not really a history of artificial intelligence as such. It's really about the people, isn't it?
It is about the people, including those two you alluded to, Jeff Hinton and Demis Hassabis, two British researchers who have been particularly important here. And then kind of the people in their orbit who have really been responsible for the gains in what we call AI over the past 10 years. There's been this real acceleration in the field since 2012. And what I want to show by going all the way back to the 40s and the 50s and tracking the progress of really one idea is show what has happened lately and what is likely to happen in the years to come.
Can we trace it back to its very beginnings, AI, or is that not possible?
We can. You know, this one idea that I mentioned is called a neural network. And this is basically the idea that allows Siri to recognize the words that you speak into your iPhone and respond to your commands. It's the one idea that allows Facebook to recognize faces in the photos you post to the social networking service. It helps self-driving cars see the world around them, pedestrians and street signs. And that one idea, a neural network, dates back to the 1950s. Essentially, this is a system that can learn all those tasks by analyzing data. It looks for patterns, say, in photos of a cat. And in identifying those patterns, it learns to recognize what a cat looks like. And that idea was first demonstrated in the late 50s by a Cornell University professor named Frank Rosenblatt in the States. And it worked in tiny ways. He could use this system to recognize large printed letters, a big printed letter A on a card or a printed letter B. But it took another 50 years for the idea to really come to the fore. And what the book does is it tracks the progress of that idea through these really interesting people. There was a tiny group of people who really believed in it over the decades. And it took that belief to make it happen.
Do we go from the basis that machine intelligence and human intelligence are similar, or are they very different attributes?
Well, you know, this idea helps demonstrate this question. So a neural network is a mathematical system that's built in the image of the brain. And these people that I've mentioned really believe in that you take what we know about the brain and you apply it to machines. It's called a neural network because it's meant to mimic the web of neurons in the human brain. And that's a rough analogy at this point.
Yeah.
But that's basically what they're trying to do, is recreate the brain. But what I always do is add a caveat. we don't know how the brain works fundamentally still all these years later. And so it's quite a prospect to say we're going to recreate it. But that's basically what these scientists have tried to do and continue to try to do.
Let's talk about these people. And I'm delighted to note that they're British, the two people that you mentioned at the start there. One is Geoffrey Hinton, who you introduce as the man who didn't sit down.
It's true. In the first sentence of the book, you realize that Geoff Hinton literally does not sit down. If you talk to him, he'll say, "I have not sat down since 2005, and it was a mistake when I did."
Goodness.
He, growing up in England, as a teenager, he moved a space heater for his mother. This is kind of post-war England, and it was a large space heater, basically filled with bricks, and he slipped a disc. And by his late 50s, the disc would slip again so often and really lay him up for weeks, sometimes months at a time, that he realized the only way of dealing with this was to stop sitting down. And that means he cannot drive a car. He cannot fly in a commercial airline because they make you sit during takeoff and landing. And this really plays into his personal story and the story of this technology, because in order to make the technology work and actually push it into some of the largest companies on Earth, he's got to make these pilgrimages across the continent, across North America, from one place to another. And he has to do it via train. And once he gets to his destination, he's got to lie down in the back of a taxi. It's a fascinating story. And it culminates when he actually has to get across the Atlantic to vet this new company that his employer wants to buy. And that's this London lab, DeepMind, which is created by the other person I mentioned, Demis Hassabis. And Geoff has to find a way of getting across the ocean. It's a fascinating story.
Goodness me. And tell me, were people acting in like him, acting at the time pretty much in solus and kind of forging their own path? Or was there a community of people who were attempting to solve these problems of making AI and neural networks, helping each other?
There was a community, but it was small, and it was centered around Geoff Hinton. And this community would grow and shrink over the years, depending on how well it was working. But it remained relatively small over the decades. And you see the connections between the few number of people who believed in this and Hinton himself. Demis Hassabis, who I mentioned, who created this lab in London, DeepMind, came out of this program at University College London that was founded by Geoff Hinton. Geoff Hinton ended up in Canada at the University of Toronto, and most of the work, serious work in this area, was going on there. So all the talent was basically centered in those two areas of the world and a couple of other areas. It was not in the United States. And when this idea started to work, some of the biggest tech companies on Earth, including tech companies in the States, but also in China, needed this talent, and they had to go outside their borders to get it, including London and Canada.
Which I guess, in turn, made these people potentially incredibly rich.
It certainly did, and that's where the book begins. At this moment, when the technology starts to work, Geoff Hinton and two of his students publish a paper that shows that a neural network can recognize objects and images better than any technology ever built. And he realizes that this is the moment to basically sell his services to these tech giants. And he sets up an auction for his services. And some of the biggest companies on Earth end up bidding for him and his three students and end up paying millions of dollars just for the three of them. And it kind of set the price for the talent in the years to come.
How amazing. Of course, with great breakthroughs, there is often a downside. And in this case, there could be said to be serious downsides to AI. And we're finding out more and more about them as the days go on. Was he aware that he was basically inventing something which could potentially be out of control?
On some levels he was, and on other levels he was not. And the same goes for many of the others who were working on this technology. Geoff actually left the United States and went to Canada because he realized that the only way to keep working on this idea was to take funding from Ronald Reagan's Defense Department, from the military. And he did not want to do that. He did not want his technology used with the military. And that's why he ends up in Canada. But what happens is when Jeff and Demis Hassabis and others in this group move into industry, those ideals that they had, those notions of where their technology should be used and where it shouldn't, came into conflict with the motives of these companies, the profit motive and other motives driving these large public companies forward. And that's the clash in the second half of my book. And you're right, it's not just one area. It's not just that Google, for instance, started using this idea in working with the military, just what Hinton did not want. Mm. It's that we realized these systems could be biased against women and people of color. We realized they could be used to create disinformation, something that is on the minds of so many of us now. The list goes on. There are so many areas where these technologies can not only serve us well, but also create huge problems.
Is there almost an ethical tangle in the fact that these programs, in some kind of way, write themselves? So I imagine that it's quite difficult to kind of figure out where maybe an errant machine went wrong.
That is exactly the issue time and again. As I said, a neural network learns from data, and the technology of the moment is a neural network that learns from enormous amounts of text. And this is basically text from the internet. It's digital books, it's Wikipedia articles, all sorts of other content. It's so much data that we as humans can never wrap our heads around all that data. And what that means is we can't know everything the system is learning. Even the creators of the system cannot foretell everything that these neural networks are going to learn from all that data. As anyone who has used the internet knows, it can be biased against certain groups. It contains hate speech. Conversations on the internet go in directions that you don't necessarily want your machines going in. And that's the issue. And that's the issue that the industry, the tech industry, and really society as a whole is really struggling to deal with as these technologies come to the fore.
I guess that most people, if you asked them whether they were contributing to AI becoming smarter, would probably not really know the answer. But of course, the data is pulled from our own data, collected in vast quantities from Google, posts on Instagram, Facebook, and all the rest of it. So we're giving them the data, basically.
We absolutely are. And you're right. It's images, it's text, it's sounds. But the other thing is people may have noticed that they're contributing in more direct ways. Or maybe they haven't noticed it, but they are. If you ever use an internet service and it asks you to prove that you're a human, it has these little captures, they call them, where you're supposed to identify what's in a photo. Is it a stop sign? Is it a fire hydrant? Just click this to let us know you're human.
Yes.
That is actually contributing to the same thing. These neural networks need that little bit of that little nudge that says this is a stop sign. And once you have thousands of people saying that's a stop sign, then it can learn to recognize that stop sign. So we are contributing in so many ways to this technology.
Goodness me, I'll never look at those capture things again in the same way. They're just an irritant to me. I never even would think about the fact that I was helping to contribute to the data.
Well, it shows you that so much of this is woven into our daily lives, and we do not realize it.
Yeah.
We're helping to create these systems, and we're using these systems, and we're not necessarily thinking about it, and which means we're not necessarily thinking about the flaws.
The garbage in generally equals garbage out when you talk about computing. And you talk in the book about a neural net, I think it was at Google, that began identifying black people as gorillas, and one that was meant to filter out pornographic images had more positives, false positives, with black people than white people.
That's right. And that really gets at the problem here. And this is something that is really in the news now because of these systems, not just image recognition systems, but like I said, natural language systems that are basically learning to carry on a conversation or helping to drive the Google search engine. You see that problem in all these systems, that they can be biased against women and people of color and biased in other ways. And it's endemic to the technology. This is how the technology is built, is that it learns from all this data. And you can't get that bias out of the data. It is there. So we're still struggling with how to deal with that. And that example of the gorilla tag with Google shows the scope of the problem. That was 5 years ago. You would think that after an incident like that, which was so embarrassing to Google and so harmful to so many people, that we would have fixed it by now. But it hasn't been fixed because it's so hard to fix. The industry is really struggling with this.
And I would guess, as we come up to date, you know, with what happened around the world in the last 14, 15 months with COVID-19, the data has got more and more and more, and we are actually giving away more data than we ever did, to such an extent you'd end up with something like China, where they have their face, or their recognition system of people's faces, which can match a name to a photo of any person within the country within a second. That's really sinister stuff.
It is, and it demonstrates the problem in another way, right? You're right. We're generating more and more data. The companies we've been discussing are focused more and more on this technology, which means it's improving at a faster rate. And that, like I said, has huge benefits. But the same technology that is helping self-driving cars evolve, for instance, can be used in surveillance.
Yeah.
As you indicated, in China, they've taken that to extremes, using this technology to identify an ethnic minority. Here in the States, where I am, facial recognition is creeping into police departments, other parts of government, and it's moving in that same general direction. When you combine those two things, right, surveillance and bias, those really start to worry a lot of people.
And then the element, of course, of control comes in, because the more data you have on somebody, and again, you can look at China to see this happening, that they can prevent you doing certain things if your data isn't good enough.
It's really true. It's funny how, as we talk about we as individuals kind of feeding these systems and helping these systems learn, we're also just providing data that identifies us as individuals, right? It's this it's this cyclical situation where we're contributing to the technology and exposing more and more of ourselves. The combination is worrying.
You talked to a lot of people for this book over a long period of time. What's Jeff Hinton's view of it now, seeing where it's gone? Was that ever crossed his mind when he was working on this in the early days?
A lot of these things did cross his mind and continue to concern him and others. And that's really, like I said, the second half of my book is the clash between those individual needs and wants of the researchers themselves and the aims of these companies. He's a fascinating person to talk to, because he does see this from all sides, and he's willing to talk about it from all sides. And he sees a lot of promise in the technology, but he's also willing to talk about where it just doesn't work yet and where it still needs to go. And some people, Elon Musk, the American entrepreneur most famously, see us as on a path to building machines that can do anything the human brain can do. They call it AGI, artificial intelligence. Jeff Hinton does not necessarily believe in that. He doesn't know why we would want to build that, for one, and he sees it as very, very far off, despite all the gains. It's sobering to talk to Jeff. He's also incredibly funny. He's an amazing person in many respects, and that humor, I hope, comes across in the book.
And so for you, having done all of this colossal research for this, what's your view about the worry of people that AGI could become as smart as humans, or indeed smarter, and start to take over the planet, and we'd have no choice in the matter? What's your view on that, having done all this work?
Well, what I try to do when that question comes up is really show people that that technology is something different than what we have today. Mm-hmm. That even though you have basically two very important AI labs now that are working on that, DeepMind is one in London, the other is OpenAI in San Francisco, founded in part by Elon Musk. Those two labs say their stated mission is AGI, this machine that can do anything the human brain can do. But what I tell people is they don't know necessarily how to get there. That's their ambition. And they say in broad strokes that if we have enough data, right, if we have enough data to model the whole world, everything that goes on, we can do this. But we don't have that data. We don't know how to use it. We don't have systems that can learn in that way yet.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, there's all in the book and more. Genius Makers, the mavericks who brought AI to Google, Facebook and the world. Cade Metz, thank you so much for joining us on Let's Talk. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Take care.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.